Listener supported. WNYC Studios.
It's the Brian Lehrer Show on WNYC. Good morning again, everyone. Labor Day this year was Monday, September 5th. A few days later, on September 9th, a huge group of workers went on strike, refusing to show up for their jobs en masse. These striking workers represent a group of more than 1.6 million American workers, all of whom receive far, far less than minimum wage. Have you guessed who it is yet? We're not talking about migrant farm workers or interns, but prisoners. We've now entered the third week of what is reportedly the largest prison work strike in U.S. history. Many of the striking prisoners' complaints are familiar, such as inhospitable living conditions in general, small portions of inedible food, understaffing, and violence. However, the chief complaint has centered around the system of prison labor. At least 11 states have had large numbers of prisoners participating in the strike by refusing to perform the jobs that they usually work each day for little to no pay. Here to discuss the strike and our nation's system of prison labor, with me is Ben Schwartz-Zapfel, staff writer for the Marshall Project and author of a 2014 Sydney Award, award-winning piece, forgive me, for the American Prospect on prison labor in the United States. Beth, welcome to WNYC.
Thanks for having me.
Also, listeners, have you ever worked at a prison job? Or maybe you're a family member of a current prisoner, maybe even a striking prisoner right now. Call us to tell us your experience with prison labor, yours or your loved ones, 212-433-WNYC, 212-433-9692. This is just starting to get publicity. It's been in some major news outlets and some not. How big is the strike, as far as you could tell, Beth?
It's almost impossible to verify the numbers that the strike organizers are putting out. They're saying that some 24,000 prisoners have participated in the strike in some way. But as you can imagine, prison officials make it very difficult to verify those numbers. And it also varies what they mean by strike. In some places, it was a one-day walk-off. In other places, the strike's ongoing. And at least in one prison where I spoke to folks, some prisoners are participating in their own version of the strike, which means not doing anything that would give their money to the prison. So they're refusing to buy items from the commissary. They're refusing to use the phones. They're refusing to use the vending machines in the waiting room. So strike can mean a wide variety of things.
What's the big picture of prison labor in the United States, or what you call in the piece correctional industries?
Correctional industries is actually a small slice of the prison labor pie, so to speak. Most of what prisoners do is basically keep the prisons running. They mop the floors, they work in the kitchen, they file papers in the warden's office, they mow the lawns. All of the things that make a prison run are typically done by prisoners for pennies on the hour. There are about 700,000 people, according to Bureau of Justice Statistics data, who do jobs like that. Prison industries jobs are a little bit more specialized. These are programs where states try to mimic real-world jobs. In these jobs, inmates might work in a metal shop. They might work in a cook-chill facility preparing foods that are then distributed to other prisons. They might make clothing or furniture. And these are generally self-sufficient programs. All of the proceeds go back into the program, and they're designed to basically be job training. These programs are extremely small. About 60,000 prisoners work in prison industries programs. That's less than 4% of prisoners. And then an even smaller slice is this program called PIE, ironically, Prison Industry Enhancement. The PIE program is meant to actually bring private companies into prisons and set up factories with prisoners as workers. And that's subject to the most stringent work requirements, and those are an even tinier slice of about 5,000 jobs throughout the country.
And can they just, you know, there's a cartoon version of, oh, you are sentenced to 20 years of hard labor. Does anything like that exist? Are people ever sentenced specifically to labor, or Can the prisons just make people mop the floors or do other things for basic maintenance of the prison facility without offering some kind of pay?
Certainly. At the heart of the answer to your question is the 13th Amendment, which, as folks may recall, abolished slavery in the U.S. But several of the striking prison workers I spoke with have said that the 13th Amendment is a sham because embedded right within it is the phrase, except as punishment for a crime, whereof the party shall have been duly convicted, meaning that slavery is not allowed in this country unless you're a prisoner. That's called the exception clause, and as a result of that, prisons can and do force people to work. In at least three states that I identify, Texas, Georgia, and Arkansas, they do not pay, so you can be forced to work for free. Now, it's sort of perhaps incendiary to call that slavery, but, you know, what else do you call it when somebody is forced to work for free?
Right. And it's probably one of the least known about lines in the entire U.S. Constitution. I have it right in front of me. It's exactly what you said. Neither slavery nor involuntary servitude, except as a punishment for crime, whereof the party shall have been duly convicted, shall exist within the United States or any place subject to the jurisdiction. So the legality of unpaid prison labor is a settled question?
Yeah, the courts, again and again, and not just unpaid labor, but all kinds of labor protections have come before the courts over time. For instance, there are states where they do pay, but you don't have a choice whether to work. So there are states where, for instance, if you're sick and you don't go to work one day, you can get a disciplinary infraction for that. And if you fight that infraction, and disciplinary infractions, you know, they can be pretty serious. They can prevent you from getting parole. They can prevent you from getting good time credits. So people get these disciplinary infractions for not going to work, and then if they try to fight them in the courts say, well, you know, the state's allowed to force you to work. That's what the Constitution says. Even, you know, worker protections like disability or workman's compensation in case you get hurt, all these different protections that the rest of us take for granted are not available to prisoners. And for the most part, when courts consider this, and they've been asked to consider it many times, they say, well, the 13th Amendment says that it's legal, it's constitutional for prisoners to work as slaves, basically.
Let's talk to somebody with a personal story to tell. Few people hanging on to go on the air. Thomas in Patterson is first. Thomas, you're on WNYC. Thank you so much for calling.
Good morning. Thank you, Brian. I just want to make a comment about the Passaic County, well, not just the Passaic County Jail, but just I take it all jails in particular, because I have friends that we speak and we talk about the experiences of the jail system. And if you worked, you'll work for free 7 days, 8 to 10 hours. You'll have enough money to maybe buy a bar of soap, if that, from the commissary. If you are sick and you can't go to work, they'll threaten to take you off your position and put you back with the general population. And, it's not a comfortable situation.
Because when you were in the jail, it was a little bit better to work than not to work, being put in with the general population? Or what did you mean by that?
Yes, because when you work, they separate you. And you'll have better accommodations, slightly better accommodations from everyone else. You know, you'll have better access to food, because since you work in the kitchen, you know, you'll bring some, the officers may allow you to bring some food in. So you can maybe gain a few pounds instead of, taking off a few pounds.
Yeah. And what do you think needs to change? Anything? Thomas?
Well, time off in particular, you know, like if someone's sick and 7 days a week, you know, like for real, no day off from work. That's one common courtesy to the minimum.
Thomas, thank you very much for checking in and telling us your experience. Here's a caller in Westchester who volunteers at a woman's prison there at the Bedford Hills Correctional Facility. Thank you for calling. You're on the air.
Good morning, Brian. The women at Bedford Hills are quite aware of the amendment that allows them, that permits the state to pay them like slaves. The most highly paid job, however, in New York State prisons, I think, is working for the Department of Motor Vehicles. They are paid a dollar an hour. And several of the women whom I've gotten to know also work. They work in a job where I volunteer, in a part of the prison where I volunteer. They also work for the DMV, but they don't take anybody's names. They just give out information. You know, what they can do is limited, but that's the highest status job. They also train puppies to be therapy dogs in the prison. And I don't know if they get paid. They live mm-hmm. with they raise puppies to become therapy dogs.
That sounds like a relatively good job.
Yeah. I think it's good for everybody.
So do you have, as a volunteer in a prison, do you have a different view of this, that it's not just slavery and it's outrageous?
No, it is. It is outrageous. I never ask women why they're there. I get to know some of the women who are working in the center where I volunteer, and I get to know some of the women who have babies there. And I never ask, you know, it's mm-hmm. not my business why they're there.
Right.
But sometimes they do share their stories. I actually was there on the anniversary of the Attica disaster. Nobody seemed to...
What anniversary? Like, that prison uprising was in, I think, 1971, something like that.
That's right. It was the 45th anniversary of the...
This year.
There was some news coverage of that. But I didn't. But nobody there seemed, and I think that was the beginning of the strike. From what I've heard, that was the beginning of the strike. But I was there. I've been there for the last few Fridays when I do my volunteer gig, and I didn't hear any reference to any strike there.
Interesting. So. Thank you very much for checking in with us. We really appreciate it. So, Beth Schwartz-Apfel from The Marshall Project, which covers criminal news organization, which covers criminal justice. Folks, if you don't know the Marshall Project, they do amazing work on all aspects of criminal justice in the United States as a news organization. How would prisoners have gotten a nationwide prison labor strike going anyway, since communication is so limited from prison to prison?
Sure. Well, the short answer is contraband cell phones. Many of the strike organizers have cell phones and communicate with each other via phone calls and text messages. They also have help from outside organizations. The IWW, the Wobblies, have an incarcerated workers committee that links people together and sends information and pamphlets from one prison to the next. But they have a pretty sophisticated communication network. Each prison has a committee where they meet, and they decide rules of what their demands are going to be and how they're going to approach it. And then they do a lot of organizing within the prison, of course, just walking out on the yard and talking to people and convening meetings and things like that. Can I also just comment on one thing that Thomas was talking about?
Of course.
He was talking about being forced to work in a jail. Now, if the distinction between prison and jail often gets lost, but it's a really important one, because if you're in jail, that means you're being, for the most part, that means you're being held before trial, which means you have not been convicted of a crime. People in jail are presumed innocent, and so this exception clause should not apply to people in jail. Now, I don't know if there's ever been lawsuits challenging forcing people in jail to work, but if there haven't been, there should be, because, like I said, the exception clause would not apply to somebody who has not been convicted of a crime.
Interesting. A lot of people don't realize Rikers Island is a jail, and so
precisely.
For all the thousands of people there, at any time, those are generally people awaiting trial or working out a plea deal or something like that. And if they get convicted or plead guilty to something serious enough, then they go to one of the prisons in the New York State system, and that's
correct.
Post-conviction where this 13th Amendment exception to prison labor would apply. So I'm glad you pointed that out.
I also just want to say that I don't think anybody would claim that prisoners working while they're in prison is inherently a bad thing. You know, most prisoners you talk to and most advocates you talk to will say, you know, we want to work, we want meaningful jobs, but we just want to be treated fairly. You know, people in prison want the same thing that the rest of us want. They want meaningful work, they want job experience, they want to be able to get out of their cells every day and do something that makes them feel like they're making a contribution. But they want to earn a little money because people get out, you know, you come out of prison, imagine coming out of prison after 5 years, 10 years, 15 years with, you know, $100 in your pocket. Try finding an apartment, try even taking a bus back home from upstate with $100. And then starting a new life where you don't commit any more crimes. It's just a setup.
So does the prison strike now in, from what I'm reading, I guess from your reporting, 29 prisons in 12 states, does it have specific identifiable goals? And do they feel as striking workers, in effect, that they can negotiate with anybody, that there's anybody to negotiate with?
Well, I think the goals and the demands vary from facility to facility. The one thing that they all have in common strikes me as perhaps a little quixotic, which is that they want this exception clause removed from the Constitution. And many of the guys I've talked to said, oh, yeah, that's a totally realistic goal. I think that within the next 3 to 5 years, we're going to see the 13th Amendment revised. You know, I don't know. And I said, are you going to continue to not work for years and years until that happens? And several of the guys I spoke to said, yeah. And I'll say, too, that, you know, when you're in prison, you really rely on those pennies from your job to buy basic essential items. You know, most people don't realize that, for instance, if you want stamps to be able to write your family, or if you want to be able to make phone calls, or even if you want to have soap for the shower or snacks to supplement the very meager rations, all of that costs money. And so to forego work for potentially years at a time is an enormous sacrifice.
Mm-hmm.
And a lot, one prisoner I spoke to in South Carolina said they've started a sort of inmate welfare fund where people who have money contribute, you know, to pitch in for the guys who are striking so that they can buy their basic necessities.
And there we leave it with Beth Schwartzapfel, staff writer for the Marshall Project, covering the prison labor strike. Thank you very much.
Thanks for having me.
Brian Lehrer on WNYC coming up next. More of your calls on the presidential campaign and the debate tonight, and we'll look at the campaign through the eyes of Arlie Hochschild. Stay with us.